Hey, wake up. New drinks just dropped at Wendy's. Cold foam, cold brew coffee, and sparkling energy. Both the caramel and the chocolate cold foam are just, so good. And the pineapple citrus and cherry limeade sparkling energy each have
80 to 120 milligrams
of added caffeine. So whether you need a treat first thing or to just stop yawning already, mornings hit different. To pick up a new pick-me-up, gotta be Wendy's. At participating U.S. Wendy's.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Rise Above Justice Movement podcast. My name is Zachary Mallory, and I am the founder of the Rise Above Justice Movement, which is a national grassroots movement of survivors and allies coming together to battle and to eradicate sexual and gender-based violence. Today, I want to give a viewer discretion is advised because the topics that we will be talking about can be triggering to some audiences. Again, viewer discretion is advised. Today, I am joined by my co-host and one of my co-founders, Gwen, and we have a very special guest today that I have come to know and I adore, absolutely love, and we will continue to amplify her voice. We are joined by a 1991 Jeffrey Epstein survivor, Jess Michaels, and you will see how powerful this voice is and how grateful we are to have her today. So I will kickstart it over to Gwen, introduce yourself, and then Jess, we will bring you in shortly after.
Hello, everybody. I'm Gwen Levy. I am a co-founder of the Rise Above Justice Movement and very honored to be here. Love Jess. And we've had a couple conversations and I just think she is such a bright light in this world. And I'm just so excited to sit down with you today, Jess.
Thank you so much for having me.
And Jess, let's kick start it by, you know, just walking us through a lot of your journey, you know, like who you were, you know, what you were doing, and then just kind of walk us through your journey, like where you were, where you are now, and then where you can see yourself heading, because you have a lot of work that you're doing and you have a lot of different things that you're focused on. But overall, you know, who is Jess Michaels?
Thank you so much, Zachary, for that question. I will tell you that I had someone say to me in this way on an interview, they said, so tell us, how did you go from being victim to survivor to advocate to innovator? And I had not ever heard it phrased that way, but it feels real and it feels very much who I am and what I've gone through. So I was a professional dancer working in New York City, traveling all over the world. When I was introduced to Jeffrey Epstein by my roommate and dear friend, also a professional dancer, she had been working for him for several months while I had been on another contract. And when I came back home, she told me all about him. And there, 2 months after her telling me about him, there was an opportunity to meet him. It sounded like the perfect opportunity for a professional dancer to learn massage, be taught by someone that knew all these international techniques. She seemed to like him and trust him and enjoy working for him and enjoy learning from him. So I took the opportunity when it was presented to meet him at his office. When I went to his office, he was very serious about learning this skill. He was stoic, very professional, asked me questions about the body that made me feel insecure about what I thought I knew about the body, given I was a professional athlete. And I recognize now that that was actually part of the strategy. He asked me to come around to the back of his desk. He opened up a drawer, and in that drawer, there was about a dozen of the same book, The Book of Massage. And he said, I'm going to have to study this book. And I left that meeting unsure if I actually had the job. And so I went and I grabbed a three-subject notebook, and I went right home and I started studying that book. When my roommate came home, she said he liked me. And then I was to call the office and set up a trial massage. Now, I've seen comments and they're like, wait a minute, that's why would someone do massage when they weren't a professional? People have to remember this is 1991. A couple things about 1991. First of all, at that time, laws and licensing was not very clear. You could be a masseuse and not have a license. In fact, they didn't even have the term that I recall, massage therapist, in 1991. You were called masseuses or you did massage. That was it. There wasn't any specific certifications. And if they were, it wasn't a big deal to do massage on the side as a professional dancer. It was not unheard of as a professional dancer to do anything in the realm of body work or wellness. I was also waiting tables. I was also a temp worker. We will do whatever side job we need to do to be able to pursue our career. And if there's a side job that pays us really well, allows us to go to auditions, allows us to take dance contracts and then come back home and have our job back, which is also a rarity, then it's the perfect, perfect situation for us. So I was very excited to go to that first, that trial massage and show him everything I had learned. I'll stop there for a second in case you guys have any questions.
Well, feel free to continue if you'd like, Jess.
Okay. So that trial massage, and I've said my story in many places, so I'm not going to go into tremendous detail. That trial massage turned into him raping me. And the reason I share my story and the reason I talk about this is because when it happened, I froze. And being the outgoing, confident, assertive person that I was before this happened, I never would have imagined that I was someone that couldn't take care of myself if something like this were to happen. I imagined that I would know how to get out of a situation like that. And when my body froze, it was a shock to me that I froze. There was a terror just in the freezing aspect. It felt like my body was betraying me. I didn't understand why I couldn't move. I didn't understand why I couldn't speak. And I didn't want what was happening. And that is a really important aspect to talk about when we talk about sexual assault, because as women, we're taught to be submissive, or as children and what we're taught to be as submissive. And so to freeze is actually a very, very common response. It's not out of the ordinary at all. And yet it's a really new public understanding that this is a common response. And when you do freeze, that part of your brain that is the decision maker actually goes completely offline. So the confusion, the brain fog, the inability to even know what to do next is very real. And again, it's really terrifying. That's one of the reasons that I talk about my story, is to talk about that freeze trauma response. When I left his penthouse, I was so confused. I got on the subway going the wrong way. The next day I went in, I was doing a work study at Steps on Broadway, and I saw my friend and she was like, hey, how did it go? And I still couldn't speak. I was still in this mute state through the whole night before and into the next morning. She asked me how I was doing and if I was okay three times, and finally grabbed my hand and brought me into the office, and I just broke down, told her what happened, and she said, we need to go to the police. And it was in that moment that I understood, oh, no one's gonna believe me. I didn't do anything. I didn't scream, I didn't fight him, I didn't run out, I didn't stop him. And so I thought, who's going to believe a 22-year-old dancer over this wealthy Wall Street guy? And again, this is 1991, where, as I understood it, the law said that rape was determined by how much you resisted. And so the only place that blame could go was on me. It was in that moment that I shut it down internally, and the symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder would begin because I felt I couldn't trust myself to take care of myself. I thought I was stupid, and my body had betrayed me. So I felt unsafe in my own body. I felt unsafe in the relationships around me, and I felt unsafe in the world. And that lack of safety perpetuated post-traumatic stress disorder symptoms, but I like to call it post-traumatic stress injury because he didn't disorder me, he injured me. And that went on for 30 years. That lack of safety in my body and in my relationships and in the world for 30 years.
Jess, I want to recognize how incredibly powerful your words are. And, I really want to, express that as survivors, you stated it perfectly. We don't nearly talk about that fight or flight or, the freeze nearly enough whenever we're talking about sexual assault, whenever we're talking about sexual assault prevention and postvention, and advocating for policies that are going to shape our lives for better, because I've always been told that the people that are closest to the problem have the best solutions. And we need to talk more about that freeze, because, like you said, in 1991, that was hardly ever talked about, if it even was. We don't nearly talk about that enough. But I want to jump in really quickly. And you mentioned about Joanne saying we need to go to the police, and you stated that your first thought was, who would believe a 22-year-old dancer next to this wealthy Wall Street guy with a plane? That literally strikes a chord in a lot of different ways, and it's true. And I know, like in my own instance, whenever I tried to report to police, they looked at me with my mom by my side and stated, "You're a man. Why didn't you fight him off? Were you not strong enough to fight him off? Why didn't you, And at that time, I was like this 120-pound gay, just like this 120-pound, like soaking wet, gay 17-year-old walking into this police department. And, I didn't have a lot of muscle. I was very, quote unquote, weak, essentially. I don't describe myself as that, but, coming from like that perspective, oftentimes, men are left out of that conversation because we're taught as, you got to be this and you got to be that, and you're supposed to fit this mold, and I'm supposed to go watch sports and, play sports and do like all of this and like these stereotypes, right? And whenever I came out against that stereotype, it was different. So I want to jump in really quick and, talk about, I watched your TEDx talk titled How Sexual Assault First Aid Revolutionizes Prevention. That TEDx talk was very powerful because it taught me a lot. And I would like to talk about your inspiration behind doing sexual assault first aid, because we see a lot of like mental health first aid, we see a lot of things like that, but there needs to be more around that prevention part around sexual assault and also the postvention, and create this, it has like this epidemic of sexual harm, right? So let's talk
Definitely.
about that inspiration behind creating Three Joannes, because it's an app that you founded, and let's jump in to that part.
I'm actually going to take us back for a second because that the piece that I just shared, that's really the moment that I was a victim of Jeffrey Epstein. And then it would take other survivors coming forward in 2018 that would help me learn that it was okay for me to heal, that I wasn't the only one. So for 27 years, I thought I was the only one. That was that survivor moment. That's when that survivor moment began. And that's when I could give myself the grace that, oh, maybe it wasn't my fault. And I could allow myself to heal. It's very hard to heal something if you believe it was your fault. And then I recognized that it had taken me so many therapy sessions for it to get through my brain that the freeze trauma response is involuntary and automatic. There was no choice.
Hey, wake up. New drinks just dropped at Wendy's. Cold foam, cold brew coffee, and sparkling energy. Both the caramel and the chocolate cold foam are just, ugh, so good. And the pineapple citrus and cherry limeade sparkling energy each have
80 to 120 milligrams
of added caffeine. So whether you need a treat first thing or to just stop yawning already, mornings hit different. To pick up a new pick-me-up, gotta be Wendy's. At participating U.S. Wendy's.
I will see comments in social media that will say, you did everything you could, you know, you chose to survive, good on you. And I didn't. I didn't choose any of it. And so I really want people to understand I didn't choose it. I didn't choose to freeze. I didn't look at the situation, make a strategy, and choose to freeze. No one does. Whether you fight, flee, freeze, fawn, or appease, some people prefer that word, it's not a cognitive choice, it's a different part of the brain. Once I understood those things as a survivor and could really grasp that it was had been take my control, not only of my body because of the physical violation, but because of the cognitive, or not even cognitive, the brain violation, that was really powerful for me to become an advocate. I really wanted to talk about that freeze trauma response and the body getting stuck in that survival mode for 30 years and the damage that it does to the body. And that was my advocacy. And from there, I started really, and so now I'm gonna get back to your question, what you were saying, Zachary. You know, how did, what happened in the moment? So Joanne is the first person I told and the first person that believed me. That's why her name is in my company. She was my inspiration. She believed me in 1991 and she did exactly what we were all told to do. In fact, it was her saying to me, we need to go to the police, that it clicked in my brain. Oh, it was that bad. It was as bad as I thought it was. It was extremely validating. And at the same time, shut it down because it meant it was that bad and it was my fault. That's where my little logical brain went. But she is the inspiration because she was instantly ready to help me, instantly. And that has not happened. I can't tell you how many times I've shared my story, even as an Epstein survivor now, where people don't know what to say. I've had people that just look at me like a deer in the headlights, maybe because it's triggered their own trauma. But very, very few people have responded as ready to help me instantly, like Joanne did. And I think that's really important to say. Sadly, after that happened, after we had that moment in the office at Steps, I was so humiliated and filled with shame internally, I didn't speak to her again for almost 30 years. I just shut it down altogether and didn't speak to her again. And she was a very dear friend. We lost touch, and dancers travel, so it does happen, but we lost touch. It would be after I started my healing, after I saw, like, started my advocacy, and I really started to see that most people do not know how. Oh, wait, hang on, my little Maggie's. Did you hear her little toes tap dancing across?
Yes, so cute.
She's gonna find a new spot.
Puppy dog.
So it would take me, oh, Maggie, come on, have a seat. Sorry. She's circling.
No worries at all. We love to hear your fur baby.
she's trying to get comfy for this conversation. She has to sit through all the interviews too, so
yeah,
she deserves to be as comfortable as we are, right?
yeah, she feels your energy. She's like, my mom needs some protection. Yeah,
she's in eyesight. So this awareness that, you know, not only does no one know what to do when we disclose, but after Sandy Hook, I recognized we have active shooter drills in every school in the country. Every school in the country now does active shooter drills all the way down to kindergarten, which is horrific. And yet our children are more likely to experience sexual harm. And we have no pre-crisis protocol. No one knows what to do. There's no preparation for it. There's no understanding in advance. This is a 911 or, hey, you know what stop, drop, and roll is for a fire? Nothing. We have nothing to prevent the damage from sexual harm. Because what we know from the research is that part of what causes those post-traumatic stress injury symptoms to last is a lack of safety and a sense of isolation. And we know that sexual assault survivors are stuck in this internal level of isolation. And that is what perpetuates our post-traumatic stress disorder symptoms. And so I thought, how do we change that? How do we teach people around us, the closest people to us, not strangers. There are wonderful advocates out there, incredible crisis centers that are doing hard work on the ground every single day. There are hotline operators that are there for us. But how do we teach the people closest to us, the people we already know and trust, to be there for us? And that is what created my idea of sexual assault first aid. And it's kind of funny how I came up with the name. So you mentioned mental health first aid, Zachary. So I found it was an emotional first aid, emotional first aid. And it was a course online with two gentlemen from Johns Hopkins University. And they had made this free class online and it had a book. I ordered the book. I was so excited to take this class. I thought, this is it. This is where I'm going to learn what sexual assault survivors really needed. So I opened the introduction and I'm looking, reading through the first chapter. Do you know, they mention in this book of emotional first aid, every single kind of tragedy, gun violence, weather-related phenomena, war, carjackings, kidnappings. They mention every single kind of tragedy except guess what they leave out in this book on emotional first aid.
Yeah, you know, and I think I love this aspect behind sexual assault first aid. And as somebody who sat through, you know, hours of mental health training, you know, in former positions and former jobs, I feel like the sexual assault first aid should be just as important. Because, and you know, like I'm looking at like the withyou2.3jwans.com website, and it talks about emotion or safety plan cover, emotional first aid, harassment and stalking first aid, and sexual assault first aid. I think that's incredible. You know, for a moment, any friend feels unsafe, and I'm reading this directly off the website, and I'm sitting here, you know, just scrolling through it, and I'm in awe of how you've turned your rage and your passion into something to help other people get through these dark times. Because obviously it's something that we've all had to learn. How do we keep going? How do we keep pushing forward? How do we help other people get to where we are? And because there's a pipeline from victim to survivor, activist to advocate, you know, it's two separate pipelines. And oftentimes people stay as an activist. There's nothing wrong with that. People say, you know, I see all of it's valid, right? Because there's a lot of different reasons. And, you know, oftentimes we're asked, well, what were you wearing? Or did you ask for it? Or, you know, these are like those common questions that I've been asked. Some of my friends that are survivors have been asked. And the ultimate answer to that is it doesn't matter what I was wearing. It doesn't matter.
Yeah.
It just doesn't matter.
Yeah.
It doesn't fucking matter.
Yeah.
And that's the reality of it. But I love, you know, the aspect of sexual assault first aid. There's something about it that just really sticks with me. I think it comes from my mental health background of suicide prevention, like, and working with survivors, you know, professionally, and then also as part of this movement leader, right? But it's just incredible. You know,
we don't look at it as an injury, and
yeah.
We, you know, Joanne did everything right in that moment. What she knew how to respond to help me, and the only thing she knew was this is a crime.
Mm-hmm.
We don't talk about this as a physiological traumatic response happening in the brain and nervous system at that moment when I broke down. That needs addressing, because we didn't even know it then. We didn't talk about it then. And so it's a shift. What I'm trying to change is language and understanding that we need to look at sexual assault as an injury demanding first aid care before an interrogation. And mm-hmm. and that's super important, because that's how, if we were surrounded, in fact, I'm gonna just throw some research that we found. So my team and I found that sexual assault, and this is across many, many studies over many years, lots of different demographics, lots of different organizations, sexual assault has the highest rate of PTSD than any other tragedy. And it's because of that isolation. Conversely, what they found is that if you surround a survivor of trauma in safety, trust, and support in those first 24 to 72 hours, and you maintain it for the next 3 months for a 90-day plan, like if you had a 90-day care plan, it significantly diminishes post-traumatic stress disorder. So if we have a plan, we can diminish the injury. It has nothing to do with justice, has nothing to do with getting the bad guys. I'm specifically addressing the injury that goes undiscussed, undisclosed, completely ignored. I have my phone off, but I don't know why it's ringing. Sorry, I lost my train of thought. I apologize. That'll edit.
No problem at all.
I don't know why. I really don't understand why my phone is ringing. Hang on. Okay. So we know that this issue has highest rates of post-traumatic stress disorder. That is a known fact. We know that from the CDC reports back in 2014, and this is 2014 dollars, that each sexual assault survivor averages a lifetime cost of $122,000 in damages. This includes mental health damages. This is physical health that becomes damaged. This is lost productivity, lost career advancement, lost relationships. And it covers how sexual assault horrifically damages our society. And yet our society, our culture has done nothing to create a pre-crisis protocol around this issue. And so I did. So that's how I went from as an advocate to an innovator. I really felt like the powers that be were not going to change anything. We keep doing the same thing over and over and over again and expecting a different result. So I think it takes new perspectives in order to change that. I also want to talk really quickly about something, because you brought it up, Zachary. There was a point where I was deciding between, am I an activist or am I an advocate? Because I didn't really understand the difference. And so I did a bit of research and I understood that activists just really bring a lot of awareness to a problem. Advocates have conversations. And I thought, oh, okay, I'm definitely an advocate. I want to have conversations. I want to talk about this. I don't even mind being challenged on my thinking about it and helping to bring someone to a different understanding. But I believed that conversations were an incredibly important part of my experience of healing.
Well, Jess, thank you so much for sharing your story. And as a survivor myself, and of course Zachary is as well, I relate so much to what you're saying. And when you're talking about how, one of my favorite quotes from you is, our wounds are invisible. We're not, as a survivor, you're not lying bleeding in a hospital bed, even though unfortunately I'm sure there are some, but
Yes.
mainly our wounds are invisible, as you said. And I just think the work you're doing is so inspiring. And before I ask my next question, I know that you had asked us to guess who was left off the list. If you want to share with our listeners, just to like, I'm sure that they're wondering what you were going to say about that, if you remember.
What he left off the list. Oh, you. Oh, yes. So
Yes.
when I was taking that emotional first aid kit course and the book, the sexual assault was left off of a list of tragedies that would require some form of emotional first aid, mental health first aid support. And so in the group for the course, I chimed in and I said, "Hello, my name is Jess Michaels. I'm a 1991 Jeffrey Epstein survivor who's been living with post-traumatic stress disorder for the last couple of decades."
Hey, wake up. New drinks just dropped at Wendy's. Cold foam, cold brew coffee, and sparkling energy. Both the caramel and the chocolate cold foam are just, so good. And the pineapple citrus and cherry limeade sparkling energy each have
80 to 120 milligrams,
of added caffeine. So whether you need a treat first thing or to just stop yawning already, mornings hit different. To pick up a new pick-me-up, gotta be Wendy's. At participating U.S. Wendy's.
You've left sexual assault off of your list of tragedies. And if you want to talk about it, reach out. And I never heard from those two professors who wrote that course. However, a few years later, I saw that they revised the book and they came out with a new version. So I thought, great, I ordered it. I got the book in. And I looked at the index to see if they had added sexual assault. Guys, they added a paragraph.
Oh my gosh.
They did not, they added a paragraph, and they mostly concerned it with domestic violence and sexual assault in the event of war.
And that is such a survivor, like what survivors face all the time. And I kind of want to also talk about, like, leading from that, this minimization that happens. And you talk about how you had this happen to you, and as someone who my sexual assault started when I was very young, a child, and I minimized it for so long. And like you said, I thought I was the only one. And I think, and as a survivor living my own life for 30 years without fully addressing my trauma and getting the correct therapy I needed, I minimized and walked around very isolated. And we talk about this isolation, which also led to my eating disorder and all these other issues that just manifested because of this horrible assault that happened to me. And I know that everything you're saying makes me think about what I have experienced, and I'm still in the trenches of really coming to terms with what happened to me, and then what happened to me after with the freeze responses, a trauma response, because you think that the minimization isn't real. And I guess what I want to ask you, Jess, too, is how did that affect you throughout your life before you were able to get this trauma therapy? Were there things that manifested for you as a survivor that you'd be willing to share?
Yeah, thank you. So one of the reasons it's actually the second part of why I am an advocate and talk about what happened. It was because of the repercussions that happened throughout my life. So there's the emotional aspect, there's the physical aspect, there's the intellectual aspect, there's the spiritual aspect, that existential crisis that happens when you end up not being the person that you thought you were, that gets broken, that sense of self that gets just completely destroyed. But to start simply, 2 weeks after I was assaulted, I broke out in this cystic-like acne. It was monstrous looking, and I've never had it since. Never happened before that. Within 3 months, I had severe insomnia and digestive issues and anxiety. And I was too scared to stay in New York City anymore. I left the city. Within 24 hours after getting off a plane from Tokyo, I was out of the city. Within 6 months, and this wasn't because of an eating disorder, Gwen, it was literally just my body unable to digest food. And I'm guessing on a somatic level, digest what happened. And I could pull a pair of size zero jeans off of my hips without unbuttoning them. I was, as a friend described to me who knew me at the time, she said, "Yeah, I didn't know what was wrong." She goes, "You just slept all the time." What would go on to happen when you're stuck in that survival mode for a really long time, when that cortisol and that adrenaline are constantly coursing through your veins, is every time that there's the slightest, something that should seem small in someone's life, that could cause a slight bit of stress, was enormous for me. It caused enormous anxious response. Over time, the digestive issues and the lack of sleep, my cortisol not only, so I had the period of time in my life where my cortisol was really high, because adrenaline is the gas pedal for you to escape something. So that was happening all the time. My body was constantly on alert. I was walking around in the world as if there was a tiger chasing me, even while I was just standing there talking to someone. That was a friend. My body was responding as if a tiger was chasing me. And the cortisol is the brakes. And so for a very long time, I had high adrenaline, high cortisol, constantly going through my brain, which is really damaging, through my body, which is really damaging. But I got to a point in my 40s where my adrenal glands were so depleted, I no longer was making cortisol. So when I had cortisol tests done, my cortisol was flatlined, like barely any cortisol. So I was just running adrenaline all the time with no breaks, and my body started to shut down. I was actually bedridden for about 2 years. I was still teaching like 6 hours a week, but I was working from bed, but it was serious. I developed adrenal fatigue syndrome, and in Western medicine, they call it HPA axis dysfunction. The hypothalamus, pituitary, and adrenal functions are severely diminished and dysregulated. So it has taken me time to eventually get better, and I am getting better. I still struggle with adrenal fatigue. I don't know that I'll ever. I will always be navigating and mitigating the symptoms of post-traumatic stress injury for the rest of my life. I am significantly better, and I struggle. It's both. And that has negatively impacted everything in my life. It has negatively, I don't teach dance classes anymore because my body has become exercise intolerant. Once my heart rate goes over a certain level, I can't calm it down.
Thank you so much for sharing all of that. I know that other survivors listening will definitely, benefit from hearing that they're not alone in having these symptoms. And there's a whole list of things I'm sure we could talk about that have happened because of, us being survivors. I really want to talk with to you, Jess. When we discussed. Had our, discussed earlier, we have talked about brain spotting. And I would really love to talk about brain spotting and just the advice you would give to a survivor who are, who's first starting their healing journey. I think it's so important that not only does our movement, advocate for survivors, but also advocates for mental health, survivors' mental health and mental health resources. And I know, it upsets me that these resources aren't readily available. And I'm someone who is, I'm in a privileged position where, unfortunately, my healthcare doesn't cover my therapy costs, but I can pay out of pocket. And I know that's just not the case for lots and lots of survivors. So if you could talk about, the advice you would give to a survivor first starting their healing journey, and where you hope that leads for almost like, I don't want to say a mental health revolution, but just like the need for that with survivors and what you hope to see in the future when it comes to mental health and survivors.
That's a great question, Gwen. I think that I want to express that everyone's mental health journey is different, and I can only tell you what I needed for mine. And I needed someone around me that would be able to, that I could trust to listen to what happened, that to listen to how my body responded. And validate my experience. So I would say the first 2 years, 3 years of being with my therapist, all I did was talk. And I'm also a verbal processor, and I needed to be around someone that was safe for me to talk to. And because I'm also I need to understand. I'm very, very intellectually curious. Like, I need to understand why something happened. It's also probably why I berated myself so much, because for me, the logical choice was, oh, it must be your fault. You didn't stop it. So that was my intellectual response to what happened. So I needed an intellectual understanding for me to be able to understand what was happening in my body. So I first needed my therapist, who I came to trust. So the first thing you need to find is someone you trust more than anything else, more than any technique, more than any specific modality. It has to be someone that you can trust. I had an EMDR therapist that I trusted for about 9 months, and then that person said something to me that made me not trust her anymore, her tr trust her abilities anymore. And that was devastating, because it would take another 2 years before I ever went back to therapy because of how much that person hurt me. So finding a professional that you trust, I think, is key. I have found that I need to do different modalities at different times. I've done EMDR, I've done breath work, I've done Reiki, I've done Muscatova technique, I've done music therapy, I've done art therapy, I've done just talk therapy so that I can feel validated and trust the other person enough. I've done brain spotting. I'm looking at neurofeedback now as a potential modality. I have found that one of the things that is really important for me is that it can't be just a talk therapy, because things are happening in my body that are not that need processing just by feeling. One of my favorite words that I've gotten out of therapy is the understanding of our capacity to handle bigger emotions. And one of the things that happens with post-traumatic stress disorder, post-traumatic stress injury, is because you're in survival mode so much of the time, your capacity to handle any more emotional information is severely limited. It's why we can be super sensitive and just pop off about something that is really minor. It's because our capacity is so limited. So one of the things I've learned is that I needed to understand my own body, learn to regulate my own emotions so that I had greater capacity within myself. And That's an emotional function. That's a body function that requires somatic therapies. I've done somatic experiencing, which is extremely powerful. So I hesitate to say that it's any one therapy, but I think it's as much a matter of who you trust. I have found brain spotting to be extremely effective, somatic experiencing to be extremely effective. I have found EMDR can be great, but it really is problematic when you have a complex post-traumatic stress history. But what I love about brain spotting, somatic experiencing, breath work, is those are all dealing with the body. And that is where mental health resources have missed the mark. I mean, I'm of the generation, I'm a Gen Xer, so I'm of the generation that, like, you just have to think different thoughts. You know, you just have to use your brain differently. And I tried that. I really, really tried. And nothing was helping. I'm a journaler. I was journaling all the time to try to just vomit out all the bad thoughts and try to be grateful all the time. But nothing was really addressing how something felt in my body, how emotions affected my body, and how my body affected my emotions. And I think that's the hardest part of my healing journey, is to accept that I have struggled to process emotions my whole life. Did I answer your question?
Absolutely, you did, and so eloquently. And like I said, I just know that hearing that.
Hey, wake up. New drinks just dropped at Wendy's. Cold foam, cold brew coffee, and sparkling energy. Both the caramel and the chocolate cold foam are just, ugh, so good. And the pineapple citrus and cherry limeade sparkling energy each have
80 to 120 milligrams, whew,
of added caffeine. So whether you need a treat first thing or to just stop yawning already, mornings hit different. To pick up a new pick-me-up, gotta be Wendy's. At participating U.S. Wendy's.
This as a survivor will help other survivors. And, you know, kind of pivoting a little bit from your mental health journey, even though all of it really goes under that, right? Because mental health affects the body, and it's an emotional, spiritual, physical recovery that you've been been explaining. So I kind of want to pivot now to, you know, speaking out and having the courage to speak out. And, you know, you were silent about your story for years, very understandably. And as a survivor myself, who was silent, of course, about my own abuse for years, and my abuser is not in the public eye, you know, hearing your story makes me think, what was that moment that made you start to speak about your story for the first time, Jess?
I think one of the very first public posts that I did was during the Ghislaine Maxwell trial. And I thought, inaccurately, I thought I was going to be able to do commentary on the trial and be able to explain things from the survivor's perspective. And I did a couple of videos, and I shared about the freeze trauma response then, but I have to tell you, I look at it now and it's kind of funny. And I left those videos up because I wanted to take them down at one point. I was like, oh, I could just tell I look so uncomfortable talking about this. So this is 2021 and early 2022. I had a viral video happen in April, I think it was like May or April of 2022, where I just was really clear. And I just said, look, I was raped by Jeffrey Epstein at 22 years old, and I didn't scream, I didn't fight. And I remember when that video started having some viral views on TikTok, and I'm looking at the numbers, it's like 5,000, 10,000, 15,000, 25,000. And at one point I just threw my phone across the room because of the visibility was so uncomfortable. And so people have asked me, how did you do it? How did you start speaking out? And I think this is a really important point. My body was not ready for the visibility. As evidenced by the fact that I threw my phone across the room, as evidenced by the fact that when I read the negative comments, they hurt me. They really, really hurt me. And I felt the need to try to fix those people and their understanding. And so that was in 2021, 2022. And I started speaking out because of that trial. But the other thing that really, I gotta say this, that inspired me so much was Virginia Giuffre. Was Virginia speaking out and just, I mean, I remember watching her and going, wow, she is truly speaking truth to power. And I thought, I could never do that. I could never do, I mean, I'm struggling with a TikTok video. Look at her doing these interviews and speaking her truth so clearly and consistently and many, many, like not stopping. And she really inspired me, though I did not believe I would be capable of doing anything to the degree that she did. I still am not sure I'm capable of doing what she did. She still inspires me today. But the difference now is that I've now been through 7 years of trauma therapy, and I put out a video mid-July that went viral, like seriously viral. I think it's at 3.1 million views, 500,000 likes, and thousands of comments and disclosures. And I don't feel it. I don't have a visibility hangover. I see the negative comments of, proof, where's your proof? Where's your proof? Hey, this no proof, then it didn't happen. And they don't affect me. I don't feel them. And I think that's the big difference now from compared to when I started. And I'm continually inspired to speak for two reasons. One, the other survivors now that I am so gratefully aligned with and honored to know and add to their voices. But two, I speak out now because I can and because I didn't in 1991. That's why.
Well, I'm blown away by hearing your inspiration and the fact that you can be so open about what happened to you, despite the negativity coming your way, and you're just fearless, just, you know, in spite of all of that. And I think there's something really to be said for how strong you are, for being able to speak out and come forward against someone who is, or was, a very powerful person. And that leads me to asking, you know, we talk about now, why now? Why is the moment now? Why is the media, who have been so complicit, because we've obviously known about Jeffrey Epstein's abuse for years, and we've heard about, you know, survivor stories, but they've been, you know, pushed under the rug for years as well.
Yes.
Why now do you believe is the media paying attention to this? And why do you think survivors are having this moment? And also, where do you hope this moment leads for survivors?
I believe it was an insanely, I believe it was an incredible miscalculation by the Trump administration to choose to shut down the Epstein investigation and not release the hundreds of thousands of pieces of evidence. I think they said it was like 3 terabytes of evidence publicly, when the administration had campaigned on it. And I know that back in 2021, when I first started talking about this, I would have MAGA in my comments saying, don't worry, Trump is on this. He's the one that's gonna blow this deep state up. He is the one that is going to reveal the truth about Jeffrey Epstein. And so I actually think it's It's the base, the MAGA base that has become disillusioned. It is the Republican base that said, wait, you campaigned on this. And it's all of us in shock that this decision was made without the input of survivors. And then a second miscalculation, going to visit the convicted pedophile sex offender, Ghislaine Maxwell, in jail, taking her word over survivors, and then moving her to a lower security country club prison. It just, actions speak louder than words. And I think what everyone in America, regardless of political party, are seeing is actions are not meeting the words, the campaign promises, the image of who everyone thought Donald Trump would be. I mean, when Pam Bondi came out with those binders, I had a fraction of hope. I thought, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe something is gonna happen here. Maybe I had a tiny bit of hope. Donald Trump had the opportunity to be a hero here. I thought, like, I can disagree with every single thing that's happening. I can think he's a horrible human. I can not like him, whatever. But if he'd solved this one thing of getting this information out, that would be a level of justice, right?
Yes.
Sadly, I was mistaken, as was every single American, because I think this is a really important point that everyone keeps asking us, you know, why now? Why are we talking about it now? Why is this important? It's not just about the past. It is about the past. But what people are missing is nothing changed after Ghislaine Maxwell went to prison. Nothing changed in how child sex trafficking laws happen, protocols. How do we prevent something from like this continuing on? Because we know right now it's likely just continuing on. Just because you remove Jeffrey Epstein and Ghislaine Maxwell, it doesn't mean it suddenly stopped. So it's continuing on. And if you close that case and you never look at the failures, the incompetencies, the negligence of the government, the FBI, the Southern District of Florida that gave that sweetheart deal. I mean, Maria Farmer started talking about this in 1996. She did everything right. She went to the authorities and they completely ignored her. There were survivors that came forward, children, 14 years old, and their mothers went to the police in 2006 and nothing happened. Documentaries came out. Julie K. Brown did her Perversion of Justice article in 2018, and nothing happened except Jeffrey Epstein being arrested and then dying, and then Ghislaine Maxwell being arrested. But there's been minimal accountability. There's been minimal change in procedures that failed, departments that failed. And so I actually feel like this is an incredible moment that people are coming together as humans and caring about this one thing together. This one thing. All of us agree that child sex trafficking might be the line, that we're not going to let wealthy, powerful men traffic children for sex.
You know, and as we've talked to other survivors like yourself, Jess, you know, we just talked to Lindsay Boylan recently, who's a survivor of, yes, survivor of Andrew Cuomo, and is an amazing person and politician. You know, it is that moment. Everyone is saying the same thing, where it seems like survivors are pushing that needle forward, that this is a moment where there is hope for survivors, that our you know, the voices, yes, will be heard. So it's inspiring to hear that from you as well, Jess. Even though it's very painful, of course, that any of us had to go through any of these moments. And you know, I guess as you've talked about, feeling isolated, feeling like you're the only one. What was that like for you just last Wednesday to stand in front of the US Capitol with fellow survivors and share your story at this press conference together? What did that feel like as a survivor where you felt that you've been alone or you felt alone?
Yeah, it's interesting because even though I did this viral TikTok and I've gotten more attention on all of my social media, or I've been on CNN and MSNBC and done all of these, high profile podcasts, I'm still literally just sitting at my computer by myself or on my phone by myself doing these things. All right, yes, do I have a team of incredible support, but it's literally just me by myself. So to show up in Washington, D.C. to meet all of these survivors, we actually met together for the first time at the NBC studio before the big interview with Hallie Jackson that happened. That afternoon was incredible because we spent about 2 hours prepping, talking, getting hair and makeup, all that stuff done before we actually sat on set and then did an hour-long interview together. And the united sense of truth, I think, and a sense of safety together was insane. It was beautiful and it was painful and it was indescribable. Because there were so many complex feelings at the same time. So then the nine of us leave that, and there were six other survivors at the oversight committee in a private hearing sharing their stories. So then we all met at a big reception that night, and we started seeing the responses from all of the politicians who sat through those six survivors in their stories.
Hey, wake up. New drinks just dropped at Wendy's. Cold foam, cold brew coffee, and sparkling energy. Both the caramel and the chocolate cold foam are just, so good. And the pineapple citrus and cherry limeade sparkling energy each have
80 to 120 milligrams,
of added caffeine. So whether you need a treat first thing or to just stop yawning already, mornings hit different. To pick up a new pick-me-up, gotta be Wendy's. At participating U.S. Wendy's.
It's so hard to describe something that is equally painful and equally beautiful at the same time. But I will tell you that the sense that we were all together for me really fueled me, and in a way that I've never experienced before. And I know, and this is also what's different, is a lot of them have all been together before, and I never had. So this was an incredibly new experience for me. They all had stories from when they did the documentaries, from when they had met for other interviews or done other things together. And I was really a new person. And some of the other girls who had never spoken up before, they were new to the experience as well. It was powerful and empowering. It was heartbreaking. It was sad because Virginia wasn't there, and they all felt it. They all felt it. But getting to have her family there, Sky and Danny and Amanda, who are incredible humans, it was beautiful and difficult. And I wouldn't have changed a single thing.
And it's beautiful to hear that it was, even though a painful experience, a beautiful experience. And I know a lot of the public and me and Zachary included were watching and very just in awe of you all being able to stand up and tell your truth in such a public way. Well, also, being intimidated by this administration with the flyover, and I don't know if you if you want to speak on that a little bit, but that, it was an it's a no-fly zone, correct? So this was very intentional, in what happened, and and probably maybe triggering as well, just to have that happen during your press conference. And that's, just one of the things that have happened, besides, Donald Trump calling survivors a hoax. And, I guess also, like, what are some of the thoughts about Trump and his reaction to all of this from other survivors who are there? And of course, yourself as well, Jess, I'd like to hear what you have to say. And I know some of these survivors voted for Trump because I guess they did think that he would release the files. So what has been that, what was like that reaction, to have this happen to y'all during your press conference? Obviously the things that, Donald Trump has been saying about survivors, and, is anyone justifying it, or is it just, kind of a consensus about what you all felt as a united coalition of survivors?
I'm going to say one thing. I have not heard Donald Trump say one kind or empathetic thing about survivors. I've never heard the words Epstein survivors, Epstein victims come out of his mouth at all. So I don't think we are a factor at all in his mind. I don't think our stories matter. And the idea of it being a hoax is laughable. It's equally laughable. If someone wrote this into a movie, that would be the comic relief. because it is so far removed from the atrocities and such a blatant cover-up of what happened. But I also want to be really clear about something. Brad Edwards said in his speech at the press conference, he said that in 2009, it was Donald Trump who had been really helpful, and he doesn't know why he's doing this now when he had been helpful. And I think that part of that being helpful quote is maybe how things get twisted in MAGA world, and it turned into, oh, well, he's the one that's going to save the day just because he happened to be helpful to this one attorney at one point in time during the investigations in 2009. I don't know, and I don't really speculate. I think that it's really important. I think there are people that need to focus on this from a bipartisan perspective, and I think from a survivor perspective and an advocate, all I can think about is how many survivors are out there that are conservatives. And I feel like if I don't stay conscientious that this is a bipartisan issue, I don't want any of those people left behind. And I get it. There's so much animosity right now with the administration for good reasons. But when it comes to sexual harm, this is a nonpartisan issue. When it comes to child sex trafficking, this is a nonpartisan issue. When it comes to child sexual abuse, it is a nonpartisan issue, and it has to be, because otherwise we will never be able to solve this. We will never be able to solve this moment, and we will never be able to come to terms on this issue. Is this the rapiest cabinet we have ever seen? Yes, it is. And do I think that there seems to be a normalization of kind of decriminalizing or making sexual harm and trafficking not that bad? I do. But as an advocate in this moment, what I really feel strongly about is reminding everyone that sexual harm doesn't actually have a political affiliation. It doesn't have and I want to be able to hear anyone that has been harmed, and I don't know, it's for me, it's from a values perspective. I really don't want to leave anyone out. I don't. And that's how, when it comes to the brain injury, when it comes to freezing, it really is a nonpartisan issue. It's a hateful and hurtful thing that this administration is doing. And I want to be able to stand up and support any survivor.
And Jess, I love that you said that, because I think we do get carried away with, you know, political parties and pointing fingers. But, you know, as we've seen, you know, talking to you and talking to Lindsay Boylan, who was Andrew Cuomo's survivor, one of his survivors. I mean, Andrew Cuomo was one of the most powerful people in the Democratic Party. And I think it's just like important to point out that
exactly.
these issues fall on both sides. And I'm really glad you said that, because, you know, we are a movement that is very much against what this administration is doing, but we are some, you know, we do want everyone to feel included in our movement. And, you know, we are told everything is political, so it can be hard to hear that someone who is their survivor voted for a proven abuser.
Yes.
But I know, right. And I know there are different reasons, and, you know, like we were talking about, it can get complicated. But like I said, Jess, thank you so much for pointing that out, because it is important to not leave anybody behind, and we want everyone to feel included.
Can I respond to something to that I think is really important, what
absolutely.
You were saying too, is that about someone voting for someone that was, you know, their abuser's best friend, because I keep hearing that over and over again. By the way, I think it was one survivor, but then another one said she was a Republican. I don't know that there's that many that actually voted for him. You have to understand, everyone is at a different level of healing, and he promised, he campaigned on this, and many conservatives campaigned on this. Say, Kash Patel, get the Epstein files out. JD Vance, we need to get those Epstein files out. So people have to understand, those were the promises being made on that side. It wasn't that they were just voting for Trump. It's that they were voting for the side that said, we need to get these Epstein files out. It was back when they thought it was just Democrats. And yes. So I want to just stand in here and just defend, you know, everyone was coming down on a survivor who was saying she voted for him and how betrayed she feels. Imagine how betrayed she feels, because it wasn't just him. It was literally every conservative. Like, what's holding up those Epstein files? We're going to release those Epstein files. It was every conservative, not just Donald Trump, that promised this.
Yes. And thank you again for pointing that out. So, you know, and we do hope for justice. And I guess that's another question for you, Jess. Do you think, you know, justice will be served at a time when we've seen time and time again people speaking out and nothing happening, as you've explained during this podcast? Do you think justice could be served this time?
Do I think justice could be served? Do I believe that the perpetrators that were clients of Jeffrey Epstein's will be held accountable? Do I believe that the systems that were in place that failed will change? Do I believe any of these groups that were all involved, like JP Morgan being found? There's actually a big New York Times article that just came out that clearly outlines how JP Morgan facilitated the sex trafficking of Jeffrey Epstein, just came out today. And there was the big settlements that happened last year, but they didn't get into the detail that this article did. So it's a good article to check out. This is so much bigger than Jeffrey Epstein and Donald Trump. So do I believe that justice is going to happen? I can't say that I believe the justice that everyone is imagining is going to happen, that the good guys will catch the bad guys. I think it's going to take more than that. I think it's going to take people out. Like, this is why I built what I built. It is outside legal definitions of sexual assault, meaning, look, it's an injury. We're not talking about the definitions of whether it's a criminal case. All I'm talking about is whether it's an injury. Did harm happen? yes, harm happened. Let's address that and help that person heal, period. And then we can worry about justice later. Let's focus on them healing. So it's outside of legal definitions, purposefully. I think we can't count on the systems, because I come from the Gen X, and there are a lot of leaders right now that are Gen X leaders, and they still believe all of the old ideas about sexual harm. Like, well, they didn't say no. What were they wearing? They still victim blame at the highest levels of our court system. They are not trauma informed. They are not, they're not even trauma aware in any capacity. And those are the people that are supposed to be bringing us justice. And so I am struggling with that idea that there will be any justice. I think there will be degrees, but it is going to take all of us together. There's going to take awareness. It's going to take policy change. It's going to take unique approaches, like what we're doing with, it's actually called the With You Too app now, that includes sexual assault first aid. So it's, my company is Three Joannes, a public benefit corporation, the With You Too app, which contains sexual assault first aid, is going to take unique situations or unique solutions, like Callisto, where it's a technology. We are outthinking the slow pace of the government. So that's the positive side. The government is slow. Everything about bureaucracy is slow, and a startup can be quick, and a startup can change things. So I think it's going to take those of us that are founders of new companies that come along and make that change. I don't think it's going to be given to us, sadly, the way it's supposed to.
And I think it's amazing how you've re-empowered yourself from going through these absolutely atrocious, appalling circumstances, and taking what happened to you and creating something that's going to help and is helping other survivors. And, you know, Jess, I have one more question for you, and then I'm going to pass the mic back to Zachary. Okay. And if there's anything you would like to add, please, the floor is yours for us, however long you would like. So I guess my final question is, you know, as there's survivors listening right now, if you could not only tell them one thing, especially those that are just beginning to think about starting their healing journey, maybe talking to their families, which is a huge thing that survivors go through, because as we've talked about, you know, it can be very, almost even harder to talk to your family about the abuse that you experienced. So if you could tell other survivors one thing about this, and also your younger abused unhealed self one thing, what would it be, now that you're sitting here, you know, not fully healed from your wounds, but scarring over, the wounds are scarring over. So go ahead, Jess. Thank you.
I think this is turning into the next level of Me Too. Instead of us putting on our social media post just hashtag Me Too, people are starting to share what happened. And I think they are feeling safe enough to do it because survivors are speaking out more publicly. And what that tends to do is make people feel safe enough to disclose to that person. I am getting disclosures in my DMs, disclosures in my emails, you know, across many platforms, in addition to my comments. And so people are feeling safe talking to me, and yet I can't respond to everybody's disclosures. So firstly, I just want to say thank you for trusting me by sharing your disclosure. And what I'm hoping is that advocates on social media that read a disclosure anywhere, I'd like to invite advocates and allies to just comment on someone's disclosure if they see it anywhere. Just say, I see you, I hear you, I believe you, you're not alone. Something that lets them know, so that I don't have to be the only one to say something, that we're all looking out for each other. But then the thing about telling family, this is where culture hasn't changed. Culture doesn't recognize that this is an injury yet. they don't believe his injury yet, and so they don't know how to respond to just an injury. And as I've said on other platforms, the way I describe it is, if I called you up in the morning and I said, hey, I went out on this date and I was raped last night, typically from a cultural society perspective, the first response is, we need to go to the police. Oh my God, I can't believe that happened. We've got to go to the police. But if I called you up, Gwen, in the morning, I said, oh, I got in this car accident last night, my car's totaled, your first response would be, oh my gosh, are you okay? You respond to the injury. And so what people don't understand now is to respond to the injury, which means, sadly, as survivors, we have to teach our supporters how to respond to us. So this is what I would recommend to any survivors that want to find their safe people to surround themselves with, is they're going to have to do a tiny bit of extra labor, sadly. They're going to have, this is, and this is just a suggestion. They don't have to do anything, just a suggestion. Mom, dad, brother, sister, best friend, cousin, coworker that you've developed this insanely safe relationship with. Maybe you're going to start this way and you're going to say, because of recent news, I've been extremely triggered about something that happened to me, and you seem like you could be a safe person for me. And so I'd like to share something with you, and all I need is blank, and it's whatever you need. All I need is you to hear me. All I need is for you to hug me. All I need is for you, is for somebody else to know. You don't even have to say anything. All I need to know is that you believe me. That's going to be the best thing for me. You fill in that blank of whatever it is you need, because when I tell you, I'm probably going to cry and I'm probably going to break down, and it's going to be a rough couple days. And I would really love it if you were someone I could feel safe with over the next couple of days to just reach out to and break down to the next couple of days. I think setting someone else up for success right now, sadly, because our society is not trauma-informed, is a good idea, because it can sometimes feel hard to even go search for therapy by yourself if you've never done that. But having that one person, even one person, though, we like to say, it's one of the reasons it's called Three Joannes, because it's the number three. Three meaning whether you're a supporter or you're a survivor, you're never doing this alone again. So if you have three people that you can figure out, who are my safe people, who are, and kind of vet them and see how they respond. And if they do not respond in a safe, if they do not respond in a safe and loving and compassionate and empathetic way, and if they do not respond in a way that makes you feel heard and believed, and zero victim blaming, then they are out. They are no longer in the running as a safe person, right? You only want to surround yourself with safe people. And you don't want to put any validity into someone that's not safe. And I think on some level, we kind of know who those people might be, but we still have to vet them a little bit, and we still need to prep them, sadly. But once you find your safe people, your next step might be, okay, I'm ready to go to therapy. Hey, you know how I told you that thing the other day? I think I want to find a therapist. I don't know what the first thing is to do. Will you help me do that? And it doesn't matter when it happened. It could have been 2 months ago. It could have been 2 years ago. It could have been 20 years ago. But bringing it all up is triggering. And that is the opportunity for us to get healing. That's a beautiful moment where the body is responding and saying, this thing over here, it's like a little alarm system. This still needs healing. This still needs attention, and it needs empathy, and it needs love, and it needs support. So if you're feeling this in your body, that's your sign. Like you need an inner circle of safe people who can then help you get the next levels of healing. For some of you, that's gonna be, I wanna speak out. And the biggest suggestion I would make to anyone wanting to speak out is try hard not to just look to social media to be the safe place to do that, because that could backfire. I think a lot of people can be really supportive in the moment, and then everyone disappears afterwards. or then the victim blaming comes in, or you have negative people coming in, or it doesn't provide the safety that you thought it did, and you still don't have those safe, close, trusted inner circle people around you yet. So my recommendation for anyone that says, you know what, I want to be a public advocate, I want to be able to speak out, I want to talk about A, B, and C and how I healed, or A, B, and C, what happened to me, and because I believe that could be helpful to others, spend time in therapy first, so that you're someone that is speaking from the scar and not from that wound. People tend to just dismiss you if you're only speaking from the wound, and that can be devastating, absolutely devastating to someone that is trying so hard to use their experience in a positive way. I think I answered your question.
Yes, you answered it beautifully. Thank you, Jess. And I love what you just said, to speak from the scar and not the wound. I'm going to be thinking about that for a long time.
It takes time, right? It takes time for us to, you know, I thought I was ready. So 2022 was 4 years I had been in therapy. And for me, it wasn't enough, because I was still negatively impacted by the attention. And I'm calling it the visibility hangover of everyone looking at me. And I'm going to say the thing that's really uncomfortable for me today. When you share that you were raped publicly, all you can picture is everyone looking at you and knowing and visualizing in their brain you being sexually assaulted. And it feels like you're walking around naked.
Yes.
So it is not something to take lightly, to choose to speak out publicly, until you have acclimated your nervous system, your support system, the people around you, and then you have a plan, like coping strategies before you say something, and for after, you know, care plans afterwards. I think that's so key.
Thank you so much, Jess. And like I keep saying, I know survivors who are listening right now are hearing what you have to say, and you're going to be helping so many. You already are with your story, and we just thank you so much. And we ask that everyone check out With You Too and Three Joannes and the work Jess is doing to help support her and continue what she has already started, and to be part of a group of survivors who understand and know what, you know, you might be going through as a fellow survivor, and to feel less alone. So with that, Jess, if there's anything else you'd like to add, please go ahead, and I will pass the mic back to Zachary.
Yes. One more thing. Give me 1 second, 'cause I'm coughing. Hang on. Yes, there's one thing I wanted to talk about the app that we're building. So we're currently in development, and we are getting ready to launch to our first test group in November. And I want to share something that we discovered in the last focus group and surveys and interviews that we did back in February. What we learned from young people, because we're not building this alone, we're building it with Gen Z. We have a lot of support from some incredible advocates, survivors, parents, educators, mental health professionals that are all giving feedback. What we learned is that Gen Z is really unique to, so what I build for Gen Z is going to be very different than what I would build for Gen X. And I initially was building for myself what I would have wanted. But the problem is that Gen Z has different problems than we did. And what I learned is, I thought if I just build this pre-crisis protocol, this safety plan for Gen Z, as long as they had it, they would use it. That wasn't the case. They told me they would likely not use it because it was just too scary. And I said, why? Why? Tell me. I said, I'm not trying to build what I need. I'm trying to build what you need. And so fill me in. Tell me what you need. And they said, it's not that we struggle to ask for help in a crisis. We struggle to ask for help ever. We feel like if we ask for help, we're being a burden. That when I turned 18, I was supposed to know exactly what to do in the world. And so I shouldn't have to ask for help. I should be able to handle it, which I understand and I could relate to. And so one of the things we are doing with the With You Too app that's very unique, we believe is very unique, is we're creating safe circles. We're teaching young people how to check in daily. How is your mood today? How is your capacity today? And we're teaching young people to check in with each other in low stakes situations, ask for help in low stakes situations, so they can learn who is safe when a crisis happens. And that's what we believe we're doing very uniquely. And that's what we believe will make all the difference in the world. Because we also know that peers reach out to peers. They don't, after 18, you don't, even younger, you don't really reach out to adults right away. You reach out to each other. And sadly, when you reach out to each other, you know, there's not a lot of knowledge there yet to understand what to do. And so that's what we're trying to do, is we're saying, here's all the knowledge of what to do, but let's teach you to reach out to each other in a healthy, safe, and productive way. So you learn these adult skills that everyone should know. How do I support someone? How do I stand by someone? How do I ask for help? And one of the really unique ways that we're doing that, Zachary and Gwen, is we're teaching them, because this is what we also learned. Gen Z is amazing. Gen Z is ready to stand up for anyone that needs help. They are ready to just throw themselves out there and protect and support anyone. They are so brave and so bold on the world stage. And yet they won't, as it was described to me, they won't ask a waitress for ketchup because that's how much of a burden they feel like. And so at one point I said, but do you realize that if you know how to do this, if you know how to support someone in a crisis, you could prevent post-traumatic stress disorder in someone that's suffering with our 90-day care plan? And they were amazed. They said, oh, tell us more about that. And I said, post-traumatic stress disorder doesn't scare you? And they said, no. They said, we're the generation of active shooter drills. We're the generation of COVID. You know, we know all about mental health. We want to know how to be there to support someone. And so we came from that direction, is how do I know how to support someone? So I'd like to direct everyone to go to 3joannes.com. Because there you'll see a BuzzFeed style quiz. It's called Find Out Your, you know, Support Style Superpower Quiz. It's your support style is your superpower. You're going to understand that there are ways you show up for people that are your natural inclinations. And then there are ways that you don't. And when we understand those different ways of supporting people, there's a couple things that happen. I stop needing to feel like I have to do everything, because I don't. I tend to be an energizer. I'm the person that comes in and I lighten the mood with a joke. I'm the one that comes on and goes, hey, do you want to go for a walk? And we can either talk about it, or I can just give you a distraction. Let's get you moving. That's who I am. But some people are really good at just being that instant comforter. Somebody's really good at being that instant strategist. Everybody's a little bit different. And when we understand what our support superpower is, and when other people see what your support superpower is, they're going to know if you're the person to go to in that particular moment. Like, you're in a crisis moment, I might go to a comforter first. I might not go to a strategist first. I might wait until I'm calmed down. We learn how to support people better. That's how we get through really difficult things together. And we don't overdo our capacity. We aren't martyrs. We aren't suffering for someone else because we don't understand capacity and our capabilities. We understand our capacity. We understand our capabilities. We know who's in our circle. We know where to find a safety plan if we need it, but we're just checking in on the daily for those low stakes, low risk ways to just be there for each other. And that's what I believe we're doing really differently. So if anybody wants to join us and stay involved with development, I suggest you go take our support superpower quiz, and then you can join our email list and our text support, because we're going to be sending little fun activities to do via text. So hope you'll join us.
J Jess, thank you so much, you know, for taking the time to sit and talk with me and Gwen. And for our listeners out there, again, be sure to follow Jess on social media. Continue amplifying these survivors of Jeffrey Epstein stories, because we know how deeply important these stories are to share. And survivors deserve justice. Survivors deserve to have their stories heard and to be believed. And continue contacting your elected officials to advocate for policies to help survivors' voices be heard. These are the voices that we need to be hearing instead of the perpetrators. Jess, thank you so much. And Gwen, thank you for being an absolutely phenomenal co-host and joining us today. And Jess, we hope to continue staying in contact with you and to continue doing the collaborative work that we've been doing. And we are so excited, you know, for your journey and to continue watching you be the advocate that you are.
Thank you. Thank you both too for continually lifting up survivor voices. Really, really appreciate you guys.
Absolutely. Gwen, do you have anything else you'd like to add?
Jess, appreciate you so much. Thank you for all the inspiration, and you've given me a lot to think about myself. So thank you.
Thank you.